Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast on Geopolitics in Asia. I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
And I'm Zachary Keck from Washington.
Today we'll be talking about two topics, the first being the recent military coup in Thailand that began this morning on Thursday, May 22nd. And following that, Zach and I will discuss the implications of the historic massive natural gas deal for $400 billion that was signed between China and Russia. So Zach, do you want to fill us in on the background of the political unrest currently in Thailand?
Sure, Ankit. So this basically is an ongoing battle. It's really been going on for at least a decade in different various formations between the so-called Yellow Shirts, which are kind of the former royal political elite establishment and upper middle class supporters, especially in Bangkok, and the Red Shirts, which are basically led by this Shinawatra family and their base of support, which is the rural population, primarily in the north and the northeast part of the country. Starting in November last year, the Yellow Shirts have been trying to basically dislodge Yingluck Shinawatra's government by calling for an unelected council to take over. Because they can't win elections. They have the actual party that was the face of the opposition hasn't won an election since something like 1992. And the Shinawatra family's basically won every election since 2001, I believe. So Yingluck Shinawatra tried to undercut the opposition by calling for an election in February, which the opposition opposed because it knew it would lose an election because it doesn't have a majority support. So they held an election in February. A constitutional court ruled that was unconstitutional in line with the Yellow Shirts' position. And then last month, it declared that Yingluck Shinawatra had been abused her power, and kicked her and about five or nine of her cabinet members out of office, and called for there to be new elections in July of this year. However, they continue on the streets. The Red Shirts and the Yellow Shirts continued to protest on the streets and the situation as they've done for the last 6 months. So finally, the military had been hinting that it was going to intervene. It had been very reluctant to intervene. But after there was a major attack last Thursday, on the Yellow Shirt protest site, the Army Chief suggested that it was getting ready to intervene. And then on Tuesday this week, it declared martial law, but said it was not taking over the government. The Army Chief then tried to bring the two political factions together for talks. On Thursday, they were supposed to have their second round of talks, and supposedly, based on the reports I've seen, the Army Chief asked the interim government to resign, and the Justice Minister, speaking on behalf of the entire government, refused, at which point the Army Chief said, "We are taking over. Then, as of right now, I am taking over power." After that, the military put out a release announcing it was taking over power. It banned Thai media from Thai broadcast from playing anything but military-approved messages and patriotic songs. It started blocking international news media outlets like CNN and BBC, their broadcasts in Thailand. It imposed a curfew. It banned any gatherings of more than five people and any political gatherings. And it arrested the leaders, especially all the leaders that were at the meeting on Thursday afternoon with the Army Chief, and then primarily, it's been going after the Red Shirt, the Shinawatra, and their supporter, the political leaders from that faction, and arresting them, and also trying to block them from fleeing the country to Cambodia. There's been conflicting reports on how much it's targeting the Yellow Shirt political leaders beyond the ones that were at the meeting. And I've seen reports saying that it arrested it had broken up the political protests. The protests in the streets of the Red Shirts, but had not bothered the Yellow Shirt protesters, who aren't protesting, but they continue to gather on political sites around Bangkok. However, other reports said they also broke up the Yellow Shirt protest camps in the streets. And so that's basically where we stand now. The military has said that the purpose of it is to restore political, social, and economic order in the country. Basically, what they're trying to do, it seems like, because this is what they tried to do in 2006 unsuccessfully, is rework a political system in order to dilute the influence of the Red Shirts, the Shinawatra family, and their supporters, to try to make it a more even contest so that the Yellow Shirts, which is basically the old royal royal allied political elites in Bangkok to give them greater influence in elections. So basically, it's trying to find a way to remove the electoral advantages that the Sinhachacha family has gained through its populist policies.
Thanks for filling us in, Zach. That's that's a lot to take in right now.
I know. I felt like I was ranting the whole time, but
yeah. No, it's a complicated situation. And it's a very important situation that has huge implications for the future of Thailand. I mean, a lot of this also seems to be emanating from Thailand's political identity as a country. I mean, we should maybe also talk about the king of Thailand himself, who's very old and not in great health. He's been ruling over the country since 1946, and a few people have been saying that he might have a role to play in this crisis by appearing more publicly and speaking about the country's political situation, which he's been reluctant to do. Information about his succession is being kept very very much on the down low right now in Thailand as well.
Yeah, that's going to be huge when he dies. But he's intervened in the past at certain points. But as you know, he's kind of reluctant. He tries to stand above the fray. And actually, the coup message today, the army chief said that he mentioned the monarchy and said that he was above this entire political crisis.
Yeah, actually, they suspended the 2007 constitution with the exception of the clauses on monarchy. So they're very much trying to preserve the king's supremacy over politics in the country.
Yeah, and the 2007 constitution was written after the 2006 coup, the most recent coup in Thailand,
right,
which again was trying to basically somehow dilute the influence of the red shirts in the Sinhalatra family.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's look at the response to the coup. I mean, so John Kerry has issued a statement, referring to this event today in Thailand as a coup itself, which has some implications for how the United States can offer military and other assistance to Thailand. What's your take on that?
I was completely surprised, frankly, because as you mentioned, under the Leahy Amendment, Patrick Leahy Amendment, the U.S. has to cut military ties with any military that it deems has instituted a coup. The Thailand and U.S. are military allies, number one. They have very deep ties. They have the Cobra Gold exercise each year. Thai military officers study in the U.S. And so the fact that John Kerry so quickly labeled it a military coup was surprising to me, especially in light of what happened in Egypt last summer, where there was a coup, basically, by the military, but the U.S., finessed its way out of that because it wanted to continue ties.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think, the biggest consequences, again, for Thailand are going to be economic. I mean, it's a huge regional economic powerhouse, particularly for manufacturing, and political instability has cost Thailand investor confidence in the past, and I think it'll continue to do so.
Yeah, its economy is... Oh, sorry.
Until it, finds stability, that's all I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, its economy didn't grow in the first quarter of this year because of political unrest. As you know, it's the second biggest economy in ASEAN, and it's big for manufacturing. Like Japanese and U.S. car makers export a lot of cars out of Thailand. But actually, if the military coup is successful in restoring the stability, actually this might be better for Thailand's economic fortunes, just because there's been this political crisis, and if that continued, it was going to reduce stability. So if the Thailand military can restore stability, this will probably be good for its economy, but it's not certain that that's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, the country has come back from several coups in the past, particularly, I think this is the 12th coup since 1932, so...
The New Mandolin, which is a blog on ASEAN, said that it counts 11 past coups since the absolute monarchy was dissolved in 1932, and 9 unsuccessful coups, but it admits that there's a couple ones that it's not sure if it was coups or not. That's how messed up Thailand politics are, that people can't even agree how many coups there's actually been.
Yeah. Well, let's hope let's hope that this remains nonviolent. In 2010, the protests led to about 90 deaths with the military kind of taking action. I mean, that wasn't a coup, but the military has been known to crack down. This does have the potential to head the other direction and lead to even greater instability and potentially more violence.
Yeah, sure, especially with the red shirts, the military and the red shirts. I should want to note, before we probably move on or whatever, that the military intervening with this coup is basically it's siding with the yellow shirts, because the yellow shirts, again, can't win elections, they're not popular enough. So the military taking this coup position is basically, even if it's trying to present itself as neutral, is basically siding with the yellow shirts.
Right.
So the red shirts are obviously going to be up in arms, and there's potential for clashes between the military and the red shirts, as happened after the 2006 coup.
Yeah, I mean, again, it all ties back to the king. I mean, part of the controversy with the Shrinivatra family, particularly Thaksin, was that he appeared to be undermining royal influence in Thai politics, which is, you know, was a deeply anathema to both the military and obviously the yellow shirt protesters. So I think it does have to do with how the military views the king as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's going to be – but he was doing this, Thaksin was doing this, but it's kind of like inevitable that someone's going to have to do this because, as you noted, the king's not in – good health. His son, in my understanding, is not that popular revered. So when the king passes away, it's going to be a huge potential for instability. So especially if there's not like popular political leaders besides him.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we'll keep a close eye on these developments. Obviously, at The Diplomat. So keep an eye on the website. We'll probably have some articles coming up soon. So Zach, let's move on a bit and talk about the recent natural gas deal between Russia and China for $400 billion. So that's obviously going to have some huge implications. I mean, first of all, you know, the timing is just impeccable, and it kind of speaks to, you know, Putin's skill as a geopolitical maneuverer. You know, just as Putin is struggling with the West over the Ukraine crisis, Putin manages to cinch this huge $400 billion deal with China for energy supply, which, you know, allows him to sort of point at it as a success that Western sanctions aren't really turning Russia into an economic wasteland. So Zach, do you want to, since you wrote about this for us, do you want to just fill us in on the details, particularly the pricing of the deal, which is really interesting?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, the pricing of the deal was a major hang-up. Negotiations went on for 10 years, and it was the major barrier to reaching a deal in the past 10 years was differences on prices. China wanted to pay less than Russia was willing to accept as far as how much it paid for the natural gas. And so the deal was for $400 billion, but the Gazprom CEO, the Russian energy giant who was the actual party to the deal on the Russian side, he said that the 30-year deal is for $400 billion, but he said that the actual price China's going to pay for natural gas is a commercial secret. According to Russia Today, if all the $400 billion that the deal is made up of is just going towards China purchasing natural gas, Beijing will be paying about $350 per 1,000 cubic meters of gas, which is the same amount that China currently pays for natural gas from Turkmenistan. But it's also significantly less than the $380.50 per 1,000 cubic meters of natural gas that Gazprom sold to Western Europe last year. So that's kind of interesting because overall Europe tends to pay less in natural gas prices than Asia. So Gazprom's actually, even if all the $400 billion earmarked for the amount that China's purchasing natural gas for, Gazprom's going to be selling China natural gas for less than it sells it to Europe. So this is, again, kind of, there's been some anger in Russia that Putin was getting ready to basically to cave to China on the price issue simply because of the situation with the West over Ukraine. And I should note also that it's not at all clear that this all $400 billion is going to be going towards just the purchase of natural gas, because Russia has to construct the Power of Siberia pipeline to transport this natural gas, and that just the China part of that alone is supposed to be about $22 billion. So it's possible that some of this money is going to finance the building of that pipeline, which means that China's paying even less for the natural gas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the long-term prospects for natural gas prices, which are clearly downwards, I mean, with the boom in the United States and elsewhere, I think, you know, pricing this for 30 years is really, I think, going to hit Russia hard in the future. I mean, natural gas prices are going to tank. And as you said, you know, this pipeline is actually going to increase natural gas connectivity between, on the Eurasian landmass, which will lead to price decreases across the board as interconnectedness increases. So I think you're absolutely right that this is Putin, an example of Putin, you know, selling out Russia's long-term interest to benefit politically in the short term.
Absolutely. But if, on the other hand, if natural gas prices do plummet, then Russia is getting a good deal, because if they go below $350 per 1,000 cubic meters of natural gas, then Russia is going to still be making that amount. So if they do this is the problem with trying to price, as you mentioned, a 30-year energy deal, because energy prices are likely to fluctuate in ways we can't currently foresee. And so it maybe in the end will work for Russia. But it's really, like you said, an example of Russia selling out, or Putin selling out Russia's long-term interests for his short-term political gain.
Yeah. I think, you know, another number we should mention is that this deal is actually going to amount to a fifth of China's total demand for natural gas currently, which is, you know, a significant amount, but it still doesn't entirely allow China to, you know, hedge its reliance on the Strait of Malacca and seabound traffic, which a lot of people have pointed out is, you know, one of Beijing's huge vulnerabilities. If we think about how China's behaving, you know, in the East and South China Sea, and if conflict does come to pass, then China would essentially remain hugely vulnerable to an embargo on energy supplies, for example. And this deal doesn't quite allow it to entirely stop worrying about that, but it, you know, does allow it to start hedging its energy requirements via land-based routes, which has been a huge priority for Beijing.
Yeah, and we should note that it's especially reliant on the Strait of Malacca is still for oil, but it also, besides this deal, this natural gas deal, which is one-fifth of its, as you said, one-fifth of its current demand, China's also signed a bunch of deals with Central Asian countries for overland natural gas routes, and Myanmar. It's built a pipeline, basically, that could deliver natural gas to Myanmar, which could have maybe helped avoid the Strait of Malacca's, and then transport it to China. So it is in natural gas, it's really reduced its dependence on the Strait of Malacca, but the oil, it still relies on it heavily.
Yeah, I mean, apart from natural gas, I mean, oil and coal are still way more important for the Chinese economy. I mean, China's, I think, burns more coal than any other country, all other countries combined.
Yeah, that's amazing to me. I just saw that yesterday in a New York Times article. I didn't know that.
So, you know, overall, I mean, this is a very significant deal and a huge boon for Beijing, but it doesn't entirely, it's not a panacea for all of Beijing's energy worries.
Yeah, and it's also, I would just point out, it's not a complete solution for Russia's worry. I mean, Russia's Gazprom especially, and Russia more generally, is still going to rely primarily on Europe even after this deal to buy its energy. So it does reduce its Europe's leverage over Russia, but it doesn't completely eliminate it by any means. So that's a factor to keep in mind.
It buys Russia some time. I mean, if Europe decides to seriously pursue a policy of, you know, weaning itself off of Russian natural gas and energy, then it buys Russia at least, you know, some more time than it would have had otherwise to begin exploring other markets and other avenues to keep its economy afloat.
Yeah, this is especially true because the power of Siberia pipeline, part of it's going to be going to deliver gas to China, but the rest is going to be bringing it to Russia's far eastern port, and that will allow it to bring ship more liquefied natural gas to South Korea, Japan, and ASEAN countries like Vietnam and inland ones.
Yeah, absolutely, exactly.
So Russia's really laying the groundwork for it to remove its dependence on Europe for natural gas. It's also now tying its economic future to China, which is, I think, problematic. And Anke, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, because there's potential for a lot of geopolitical disputes between Russia and China over Central Asia, over Russia's Far East and China migration into that, over China's disputes with Vietnam and India, both of whom Russia has strong ties with dating back to the Cold War. So what do you think about this?
I'm sure Putin has considered all of this, but I think, you know, these are kind of bridges that Russia will cross with China when they get there. I mean, obviously right now, you know, China and Vietnam are engaged in a major conflict in the South China Sea. But again, I think the political expediency of signing this deal outweighed any other consideration at this point for Putin. I mean, you have the St. Petersburg Economic Forum coming up, you know, where Putin is going to have to convince investors and leaders that Russia remains economically strong and robust. And I think you can't really ignore the timing of this deal in that sense. I mean, that was the number one priority for Putin.
Yeah, and so I think this again, like, I think Putin's history is not going to be kind to Putin, because, I mean, he had high energy prices the whole last decade. He didn't do anything with these to like reduce Russia's overall dependence on this on energy exports for its gross domestic product. It didn't modernize the economy, basically. So he remains really popular because he's nationalistic, because economics has been better under him than it was under Yeltsin. But I just think in the long term, he's really setting Russia up to fail.
Yeah, I mean, we'll also have to see how the pipeline construction plays out, because, you know, oil and natural gas pipelines are notoriously fickle projects, fraught with risk. I mean, there's a very likely prospect that these pipelines could be significantly delayed, and that could also raise China's ire and cause problems for the Russia-China bilateral relationship.
Yeah, definitely. I think they said, Financial Times reported, citing China National Petroleum Corp yesterday, that the Russian gas will begin flowing to China in 2018, but that doesn't even seem possible to me, because the Power of Siberia pipeline isn't supposed to be done to at least 2019, possibly 2021. So I don't even really understand that, unless it's not going to use the Power of Siberia pipeline initially.
Yeah. Who knows? We'll see. We'll see where this ends up leading to. All right. Well, that about wraps it up for this week. Thanks a lot for listening.
Thank you.